You're listening to WCOM LP 103.5 FM Carborough and Chapel Hill. It's a Tuesday, it's 5 o'clock, and that only means one thing. It's time for another round of Snarky Faith with your host, Stuart Deloney. This is a space where we irreverently wrestle through life, culture, and spirituality, all with our heads in the clouds, our tongues in our cheeks, our hearts in our sleeves, and our feet on the ground. At Snarky Faith, the questions or even the answers are never the point. It's all about the conversation. So here's your host, Stuart Deloney.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to another round of Snarky Faith Radio. I'm your host, Stuart Deloney, and welcome again here to Snarky Faith. And if you are a new listener to our show today, I'm sorry. No, I'm joking. Welcome to be part of our show. And as we hop in to Snarky Faith today, what we're going to be talking about, we are going to be sitting down with an author, the author of the book, the upcoming book, Good White Racist. We'll be sitting down with Kerry Connolly in a little bit, talking about the subtle ways that we are still just racist a-holes. Actually, I would be totally up for, and this is going to be a terrible statement for me to begin this show with here. I would even double down on saying, man, I wish like half of America would just kind of be a little racist. Not like a lot of racist, but like a little racist. Like I would go for that. Like I feel like that would be a step forward if we could get all of America to just be subtly racist. Now, I'm going ahead and saying this, that being racist at all is a terrible thing. I am not endorsing racism by any decree, any way, shape, or form here. But it would be more civil in America if we could at least pull people to just being slightly racist as opposed to being full-blown racist. Yes. So I've already said racist way too many times in the first 2 minutes of the show. So before we get to our interview with Kerry Connolly today, so I want to begin with a little bit of a Lenten meditation. Mm-hmm. Didn't think I was going in that direction. So this comes from Aaron Damani. I'm just going to commit to that. Aaron Damani, who wrote the book, The Good of Giving Up, Discovering the Freedom of Lent. And so Aaron's wise words will help us as we are in this season of Lent here. He says, when we practice Lent in the spirit of Jesus, it's not about making God happy, looking spiritual, or repeating empty traditions. It's not a power move or a forced march. Jesus and the cloud of witnesses show us that Lent is about Jesus and therefore about love. The Holy Spirit uses fasting, prayer, and generosity to satisfy us with God's fatherly love. And as a result, we are moved to share love with others. And that is a history worth repeating. And I do. I like those words. I like those words of us being a people that are based out of and known for our acts of love. So on that deep and kind of meditative thought, here's what I'm giving up. Here's what I'm giving up for Lent this year. I'm giving up BS for Lent. And I'm going to go ahead and ask you guys too. You may have already had, I know we're well past Ash Wednesday, but you know, I think God's all right with a little bit of a U-turn on your Lenten practice. Maybe you gave up swearing. I don't care what you gave up. I really just think that you just need to like just pump the brakes right now, grab the e-brake and stop it and go ahead and say, we want to give up BS. We want to give BS in our faith tradition here for Lent. I just think that would be one of the most beautiful things that we could see here. And I do think the Spirit of the Lord would be well amongst us for doing such things. So you think I'm being sacrilegious? Probably I am for saying this. But, you know, let's talk about some of the petty BS that is Christianity before we even get to the Christian crazy of the week. This is petty. So guess what? Now, this comes from our dear friend, the Friendly Atheist. And as he posted this recently, it's ridiculous, but it's true. According to some Catholic leaders in Chicago, at least, eating the Impossible Burger still breaks the spirit of religious law. That's right. For Catholics that aren't supposed to eat meat on Fridays, eating the Impossible Burger, the burger made from plants, the non-meat burger, It's breaking the spirit of religious law here. Oh, no! Yes, as the Chicago Tribune had explained, quote, "You're at risk of losing the whole spirit of it," said Todd Williamson, the director of of the Office of Divine Worship of the Archdiocese of Chicago. Yes. So you're at risk of losing the whole spirit of Meatless Fridays if you substitute meat. What? Come on. Some people are just trying to help the earth out here. Todd Williamson, you're just being a wet blanket here. You're here to ruin our fun party. Some people thought they had a loophole, and then you got to go and do this. What? This is insane. This is insane, and this is crazy, and it's petty, and it's stupid, and it's BS. It's total BS. It has nothing to do with Christianity, following Jesus, anything of this. This is like yeah. That's all I'm going to say on that one. And hey, lady friends out there, lady friends, we have a lot of lady friends on the show here. And I feel like I can speak also on behalf of my sisters here. I have a wife and I have two daughters. It doesn't mean I know the plight of being a woman, but it does mean that I have been adjacent or in close proximity to the plight of a woman for many years. So I can kind of like, you know, brotherhood, sisterhood together a little bit here. Yes. Okay. So Rachel Jones, who's the author and editor at the Gospel Coalition, had written a piece recently about her fight with the flesh. The flesh, the sinful nature of her spirit, talking about her issues with PMS. Yes. Because I'm just going to read what she says here. Because again, yeah, she wrote this. "On Sunday, I snapped at my mother on the phone. On Monday, I woke up before my alarm and spent a lonely hour lying with my eyes closed and my mind whirling, anxious over decisions for the future and despairing about the right direction of life altogether. That night, I did it all again before going to sleep. On Tuesday, at work, I simultaneously wanted to cry and punch someone. 2 days later, I started my period. Hormones had won again! And in some senses, the way I think about my hormones ought to be the way I think about my flesh all month long. Paul says that there's a war going on within us." She goes on to say, "My hormones made me do it," is the cry of many PMS sufferers. "And yet, it's also true that I did it. As such, our hormones heavily demonstrate how our sinful nature is part of us and yet not us. And Christ, the flesh, does not define us. It does not need to control us." Oh, girlfriend, shut the hell up. I'm sorry. I'm not saying that in a like patriarchal way or in a like misogynistic way. I'm saying that in a literally I'm in the boat with my sisters out here in the world. That what? Now you're trying to judge people based upon how they're dealing with PMS and cramps and hormones and their period and things that I don't fully understand, but I can say the words because I've listened to my wife and my daughters plenty. And I know how to, I can't empathize, but I can sympathize. But seriously, yes, really, we're going to now shame women for not feeling well during the before and during their periods? Really? Yes. What did I say earlier for Lent? What are we giving up? We're giving up BS is the way that we're supposed to do that. Yeah. You know, we kind of do that, you know, like that call to prayer and response type of a thing too. Yes. This ain't liturgy, but you're getting my point. Okay. So what I want the most for Lent is for us to be able to give up the insanity of all of this. And I mentioned this because this bit of crazy ain't the crazy we're going to get to within the Christian crazy. And you're not even there yet. I know. I keep getting closer and closer to this, but you know what? Okay. Here's our primer for this. So this comes from the Christian Post. Oh, Christian Post. You say that you're a news publication. All right. So they published an article called "Four Ways Christians Can Make Sense of Coronavirus in a Fallen World." How can we make sense of coronavirus? Yeah, I'm not even going to dig too deep into this, but it's going to lead into something else we're talking about here. So number one, how do we make sense of it? Sin subjected the world to futility. Sin is a part of the world, and the coronavirus is a part of sin. It's all sin's fault. We can be mad at the virus, but really, we should be mad at our sin. Sure. Yeah. All right, number two. This article. Sometimes sickness is God's mercy. I'm sorry, what? Sickness is God's mercy. Oh, yes. Trying to make the... They're trying to make the argument that, hey, some Christians are going to die, but guess what? They go to heaven to go be with Jesus. And you know, the other ones, they had their chances, so F them. Sickness is God's. What? God's mercy. Yeah. Again, this is disgusting. This is bizarre. This is petty. But speaking of the coronavirus, we're only getting started. Ah, number three. We could see it as mercy, but we can also see it as judgment. Ah, that's right. Sometimes God uses illness to bring about judgment upon those who reject him and his way. So you can have it both ways. You can have peanut butter and jelly. If a believer dies, it's because God's showing his mercy. If a non-believer dies, it's because it's judgment. So, hey, I get to have everything I want. And lastly, as the Christian posts, and they're great journalistic writing would tell us, the reason for that we can kind of see why the coronavirus makes sense is God's thunderclap. Huh? Excuse me? I'm sorry? Let me go ahead and quote directly from them, because that doesn't make any sense to normal people or me. Not that I'm saying I'm a normal people. Okay, so they go into Luke 13, 1 through 5. Piper says that all natural disasters... Ooh, Piper. Yes. Piper says all natural disasters are a thunderclap of divine mercy in the midst of judgment, calling all people everywhere to repent, realign their lives by grace with the infinite worth of the glory of God. God's infinite worth and glory tells us, hey, if you're not on the bus, get off the bus. And if you get off the bus, you're going to die. But actually, either way, you're going to die. Because you either die out of God's mercy or you die out of God's judgment. So, yeah. I don't know. This is the kind of BS that we're getting to, right? That we want to repent of, because this is crazy. This is totally crazy BS. Four ways a Christian can make sense of the coronavirus in a fallen world? What? No! It's a sickness! We've had sicknesses for eons. That happens to us because we are living organisms, and sicknesses and things like this happen. We have an immune system. Yes, all of this is part of it. But. If we Christians, we don't lose a chance to somehow spin something into just heinous judgment. So yeah, we can take anything and turn it into something judgmental. Oh, such. Is that one of the spiritual gifts? If it's not, it should be. And I'm going to make it one. I'm joking, but I'm talking about the coronavirus here to lead us into our Christian crazy, because guess what? I know it's going to be shocking to most of you, but in the Christian world, people are kind of giving a lot of bad advice. People are giving a lot of bad advice about the virus pertaining to the coronavirus. So let's go ahead and hop in to the Christian crazy of the week.
Lord have mercy. The Lord is my shepherd. He know what I want.
In the Christian crazy this week, I got to give a little shout out to Jim Baker. Now, we featured you a few weeks back, Jim, selling your silver solution to cure the coronavirus. But you made it to the big leagues, buddy. Well, good on you. Jim Baker was actually featured on Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. Yes. Where Jim was featured talking about how his silver solution will cure the coronavirus. But you know what else won't cure the coronavirus? Pat Robertson's advice. So, Pat, what do you think, buddy?
80% of the immune system is in your gut.
That's right. It's because these little bacteria along our gut lining, they produce antibodies that help us fight disease.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, I have in front of me, I got one of our gentlemen to go out and buy some stuff. These are things that you can get, and you can have a healthy gut. If your gut is healthy, you don't have to worry about corona.
I mean, this is solid advice. I was always told by my grandmother, as long as you can poo, you don't get the flu. I just made that up because it rhymes, because it doesn't make any sense. So what? What? As long as you're eating Activia like Jamie Lee Curtis, you're immune. You're immune from the coronavirus. You want some more bad Christian advice on how to handle ourselves during the coronavirus? Well, I'm going to give it to you. I'm going to give it to you right now because you knew. That's kind of how I was setting it up, right? Isn't that kind of how it was going to work? Well, we've got Rodney Howard Brown telling us, hey, you don't need to prepare because you don't need to care. Oh, man.
And we just stood and declared, we cursed that thing in the name of Jesus. And Zika disappeared. We are doing the same thing with the coronavirus. We do not need it on these shores. And obviously, somebody said, well, what about the rest of the world? Look, I can't be responsible for every city or whatever.
Rodney ain't got no time for that. He can only care about his own country. Hey, nationalism. You know who else is happy about the virus? Oh, True News.
True News is going to go through this global pandemic, and we're only going to get bigger. You know why we're going to get bigger? Because God is trying to get a message to the world. We're on the edge.
On the edge of glory, and I'm hanging on a moment of truth.
I'm a sucker for a good duet. I mean, you thought Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga were great and shallow, but Rick Wiles and Lady Gaga and their new True News rendition of Edge of Coronavirus. It's just so beautiful. It's so beautiful. So beautiful. When are we going to have A Star Is Born too? Oh, God. It's so beautiful. But we say all of this to prove a point that most of the folks, especially in the religious right, are moving in ways that are insane. Insane, especially in response to the coronavirus, because this is insane. This is BS. This makes no sense. People don't need to worry about Mike Pence praying the gay of the corona away in order to help us. No, we need to be awake, aware, soberly minded, and doing what it takes to be able to protect yourself and help those in your community and help those around the world that are suffering. This isn't a weird, weird religious way we need to respond in it. That would only just make it Christian crazy. All right, so enough of this craziness. It's fun. It proves the point. Because we don't want to be a people. We don't want to be a people that follow after Jesus and completely obscure our brains with a bunch of crazy BS. No. For us to be able to really handle the world and walk into the world in effective ways, we need to be able to kind of push aside the BS and have clear and sober talk. And that's why today we're going to be talking with the author of an upcoming book, Good White Racist. Here we go. All right, I'm sitting here today with Carrie Connolly. Carrie is a writer. She is a certified life coach. She is an author of the no-nonsense blog, Jersey Girl Jesus. And she hosts the podcast White on White, which I'm assuming has something to do with just rice. Maybe? I don't know. No, probably not. No, White on White, which reimagines white identity apart from pseudo-supremacy. Carrie's also about on the doorstep of finishing up her MDiv at Christian Theological Seminary. And we won't hold it against her that she is also, she lives in Jersey with her family. So proudly. Yes, welcome, Carrie, to the show.
Thank you so much. I am a proud New Jerseyan, and I have no idea how to put my own gas. So that's totally true. That is a completely true stereotype.
Is that a Jersey thing? Because that is also, I don't know if it is anymore, but I used to live in Washington State, and Oregon used to have the same rules where you could
not. I've heard that. I don't know if that's true or not, but we do not pump our own gas out here, for sure.
You guys are a bunch of lazy people in Jersey. No, I'm joking.
But we have good hair, man, because we don't have to get out of the car. So on a rainy day.
I love it.
It's all good.
It is, because it is difficult to learn how to pump gas.
It really is. I was terrified when I drove to Connecticut and I ran out of gas. I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? I had to ask for help. It's all good.
Carrie is here because Carrie has a book coming out that's going to be dropping March 17th on Amazon called Good White Racist, Confronting Your Role in Racism. So we're going to be talking about, yes. What does it mean to be a good white racist? So Carrie, tell me, do I need to go out and start buying my white hood? I mean, what does it mean to be a good white racist? I don't know.
Please don't do that.
Okay, thank you. I won't.
Please don't. Yeah, no, those are not the kinds of racists that we're talking about here. So being a good white racist is essentially a lot of white people, a lot of people who genuinely are good people, but also probably don't understand that they are also a paradox and they are not able, their sense of goodness kind of makes it a little hard for them to see their own inherent bias and their own socialized racism that's been kind of inculcated into them.
And I like what you do in the book. And I will tell you too, I've enjoyed this. I've enjoyed going through the book. And I did tell you earlier, but I'll just brag about you on the air, that it has led me to have some interesting conversations with my children. I have all roughly teenagers at this moment in life. And I am white. My wife is white. So vicariously, so are my children. So, you know, we wanted to really be able to confront ourselves to make sure, you know, where we're at and to continue to educate them. And I thought this has been what you've done is you've laid out a very just good overview of so many things that you dig into. Kind of trying to hit this mosaic of issues of racism here in America. And one of the things that I loved that you were bringing out in this, and you kind of mentioned this a little bit, was the idea that we want to try to live as binaries oftentimes, but we need to learn to kind of wrestle in the paradox of it.
It's true. Because like the human brain wants to do that. That's like a neurobiological thing, right? That the human brain wants to find safety. So we have to kind of say something is good or bad, safe or unsafe. And so it's a natural thing to want to be able to find clear-cut answers to anything. But if you've ever loved somebody, then you've probably had an experience where you have loved them and been infuriated with them at the same time, right? Like you can passionately love these people and be so mad at them at the same time. Well, that's a paradoxical experience, right? And so what I am hoping to help white people understand is that they can be good people who truly do stand against racist ideology, and yet they can also be hella racist. They can also do things and say things that are incredibly racist, even if they have the best of intentions. That can still happen. And I think what happens is so often when that happens and white people are called out for it, we get really defensive because we are so consumed with two things. We're consumed with our own comfort level and making sure that nobody thinks we're bad. And our own goodness, right? So like we get uncomfortable when we have been confronted and we want people to believe in our goodness. And so that stops us from being able to practice a sort of a real self-awareness around how these racist ideals may have been put into our brain, be operating in our brain, and then how we participate in systemic racism.
And you put it very well, this, and I'm going to go ahead and quote you on this, and we'll unpack this statement, because there's a lot to talk about in this. Okay. You say in the book that we hide from our own shadow side, unable to hold the paradox that, as generally good people, we can do incredibly bad things. The truth is that if you look at the body of our work as a nation, the whole history, and not just the bits we like, there are two things that are true. America is gleaming. We are inherently idealistic, a beautiful experiment in the human imagination and potential, and we are evil. We are a gluttonous machine of turning gears that mangle the souls of men, women, and children alike. And each one of us, every single one of us, is a participant in this absurdity. So talk a little about that, because when we're talking about this, living in the paradox, we have to be able to like wrestle with both of these things, especially in our identity as Americans.
Yeah. I mean, I think about our founding fathers, right? Like these, and I'm kind of use air quotes around them. But the people who thought up this great experiment of America, they had these incredible ideals. And if you look at them, if you just look at them apart from what we know about many of our founding fathers, right, as slave owners and all that kind of stuff. If you look at the ideals of that they wrote down on paper, they seem pretty amazing, right? They seem God ordained. They seem like they would be of a higher purpose, right? Something that was all about human flourishing and just the highest possible ideal that you could attain as a human being. And yet, at the same time, the people that came up with those ideas were people who owned other human beings, who, you know, raped some of those human beings, had children that they did not acknowledge by those human beings. You know, these are realities that we cannot deny, right? We also can't deny that through our history, there have been many immigrant groups that have come to this country who have proceeded as a people group to come up through the social ladder, find success, assimilate into our culture successfully, and then they've turned around and become hella racist, you know, like against the next group coming over, right? So we are, as human beings, I think it's a human state to be paradoxical. Until we can understand that about ourselves and then understand that about our society and about our country, we're not going to be able to do anything about the evil that we perpetuate every single day.
Mm-hmm. And I know you do a lot of work in this in the book with being able to kind of speak to us in a way that you acknowledge the fact that it is never fun to be confronted.
Mm-hmm.
It is never fun to be confronted with our own racism and that's exactly the point of where we're at, that we have to be able to move into spaces that lead to our own discomfort if we want to be able to move out of the place that we're in. And change is never fun. So why this book? Why you? Why now? You know, talk a little bit about like your journey towards writing this and how, you know, because this is, it's at least it reads to me like an intensely personal journey.
Yeah,
that you have been through, because you're calling stuff out, but you're also speaking from your own, the depths of your own journey as well too. So it feels very authentic in how you're laying this out.
Yeah, that's cool that you felt that. It's true. Like 10 years ago, if you had told me I would be writing about race and racism, I would have told you were crazy. Back when I was in my first round of undergrad, I've been a few times, but my first round, I had a very racialized experience where, as a white woman, I had a black woman who I realize now I think was probably mentally unwell. But she threatened me with a knife. She said she was going to shove a knife up my white ass, right? And so I really teetered on the brink of being a very different person. And I wrote a letter to the Reverend Dr. Calvin Butts, and he responded to my letter. And that was the beginning of my racial healing from that experience. And when I say that, like, she would walk through the hallways yelling, "I hate white people," right? So when I say that was a racial, it was a highly racialized experience. But I didn't give race much more thought because I was really happy in my nice little white bubble. I just thought, you know, I like black people as much as I like anybody else. I'm not a racist, which isn't true. So when I started writing Jersey Girl Jesus, and I started seeing things on the news about racial injustice, and at the same time was working at a church that was a pretty diverse, racially diverse church, and came into deep personal relationship with people of color, all of a sudden the stories that I was seeing on the news began to have faces that I cared about, meaning that like I could start to picture this happening to someone that I loved deeply. And that started to really bother me. So I started writing about this stuff, and those were on a blog called Jersey Girl Jesus. None of the Jesus-y stuff that I wrote got any hits, but anytime I wrote about race, people freaked out, like white people freaked out. And I started going, whoa, what the hell is going on? Like, why are white people so afraid to recognize that, hey, we have a problem here. Like something is not right. And so as I began to get more educated about how race and racial dynamics and racism, systemic racism works, I started to kind of recognize and be in these conversations more often. And that's when I started to recognize my own defensiveness, my own resistance to wanting to recognize my participation in this racist system and the ways that my thought patterns, my belief systems perpetuated it, and the way that I wanted to stay silent. It would be so much easier to stay silent. Now, as a white person, I can't speak for a Black person. I can't speak to the Black experience or what it's like to be a person of color. So when I figured out that I wanted to write a book about it, I knew I couldn't write about the Black experience, about what racism is like for Black people. I knew that what I had to do was instead begin to uncover whiteness. And by design, whiteness system, in any system of dominance, dominant identities are always invisible, especially to the dominant identity. The people that hold that identity don't see their own dominance. And that's what I began to understand about white people, is that we just don't see our own dominance in this system. And that's what I'm hoping the book will break down.
So when you be able to talk about that, and I do, I love how you were speaking to us out there that lack pigment. Let's just start with this part too. Like how do we benefit from perpetual racism? Like in common life in society. Yeah.
So, you know, just this morning, and I'm hoping that I can, cause I'm teaching a class based around the book. And I'm really hoping that I can find this woman out on Facebook. So maybe you can help me. She's right in Montclair, right down the road from me, Montclair, New Jersey. She is from Newark, and she put a post on Facebook. And she is a Black woman who goes to the Montclair YMCA. And she told a story. She was sitting in her car, and she was so angry, and she was so upset. And she has about a 15-minute long video, Facebook Live, that she did. And it's in it, she tells the story about how she was bringing her daughter to the Y for a class, and a white woman came up to her and was like, well, what are you doing here? Like, why do you come from Newark? I'm so confused. Like, isn't there a place, a Y in Newark that you could come to? And all the white people that were there, she said, would come up to her and be like, I'm so sorry you're going through this. I'm really sorry that you're having to deal with this. But nobody told the white woman to shut the hell up. Like nobody went to the white woman and said, like, bitch, you don't have the right to be asking her this question. Like, stop it. Like, leave her alone. Nobody said that to the white woman. And that's white privilege, right? Mm-hmm. Now, what she expressed in that very moving curse-laden diatribe that she put on Facebook, and I don't blame, I supported every single F-bomb she dropped because it was such an infuriating situation. What she said was like, I, as a Black woman, had to keep my shit together. Like, I could not lose it because as a Black woman, what's going to happen is this white woman is harassing her, walking, following her through the Y as she's trying to leave, trying to tie her kids' shoes, trying to leave, and asking her to justify her presence at this YMCA, at which she is a member, right? Mm-hmm. And nobody is calling this white woman out. Everybody's going, oh, sorry that you have to deal with that. But nobody's calling her out on this. Mm-hmm. And this woman is in any situation that any white person would be like, you know, back off, lady. She had to be polite. She had to keep her cool. She had to be completely reserved in the face of completely ridiculous crap. Because she's Black. And if the cops had gotten called, she would have been the one who went to jail. She would have been the one whose kid would have gone into foster care, possibly, if like nobody could come and pick her up. Or, you know, that's the kind of privilege that white people don't ever recognize we have.
And oftentimes I think that when we are confronted with things, whether they be minor, like small little faux pas that we're pulling, or when we see it happen, like this situation you're meaning, or that as we've seen all of these, like there's like the corner store carols or the the cookout, whatever Karens, you know, that we always that find on the news where these white women are acting terrible. But I think that what keeps us where we're at oftentimes is just this idea of like justification. I'm not that. Or comparison. Well, at least I'm not that.
Right, right. I'm not wearing my white hood today, so I'm fine. Like,
that's right.
I mean, like, and what I think that we don't understand is that the emotional labor, the amount of emotional labor that Black people have to do just to keep their shit together in the face of stupidity from white people is so exhausting. It's so exhausting that it's just something that we don't understand. We don't understand what it's like to have to carry that added. It's essentially a level of trauma. It's a trauma response in our bodies that we don't have to carry. And it's another part of my personal process was, and I say this very, very, very carefully, because I am a white woman. I am a white, straight, Christian, you know, cisgendered, middle-class white woman. So I'm like one step away from the top of the privilege heap, right? But as a woman, I have encountered microaggressions from men. I have encountered microaggressions from men who touch my body when they think it's appropriate to touch my body whenever they want to say things about my body whenever they want to make innuendo or to question my intellect or my ability, my authority in a certain situation. That kind of stuff happens to me all the time. That was one of the things. Now, I have no idea what it means to be Black. I'm not trying to say that I do, but that was one of the things that helped me to start to understand, oh shit, if I'm going through this as a white woman, how much more so must people who are of color go through, especially women of color, who have to deal with the intersectionality of those two things, right? So that's kind of a little bit of what helped me start to begin to understand my own responses to being called out.
One of the things I do appreciate that you do in this book, and as you're breaking down these different areas that we need to repent from, we need to contemplate that what's going on in our own space too, is that you also give us action items at the end of these chapters, because oftentimes I feel like we can get in talks of racism, we can get caught up in kind of ideological discussions or like philosophical discussions where it's kind of just in the nebulous, it's in the cloud, like we're just kind of talking about things in general terms. But really what you're trying to lean in is pushing us towards praxis, like how do we actually begin to confront this. I really, really appreciated that, and as we begin to look at this, like what are ways that we can begin to confront this in ourselves aside from buy the book.
Thank you. That's a good one. Or take the class. That's good too. So confronting it in ourself is first, it's the most important work, right? Because there's a difference between just being a nice person and being a true anti-racist, right? And anti-racism work, first and foremost, has to begin within ourselves. Where we can start. And the other, one of the things that a white person taught me, she was Carolyn Helsel, I think is her name. She was my first guest on the White on White podcast. And she said, it's not like you're going to do this work and then wake up and all of a sudden you're a good white person, right? Like, that's not the way it works. This is an ongoing layered thing. And unfortunately, I think we have to kind of understand that there's always going to be, just when we think we got it, there's always going to be another place where we go, oh, crap, like, damn it, there it is again, you know? So I think it's really important to get comfortable with being uncomfortable and being able to recognize our emotions as they are happening, because a lot of times we just move into defensive mode before we recognize that we're feeling defensive. We just start talking. We just go, oh, no, that's not what I meant. That's not, you need to understand. I love it when people tell me what I need to understand, by the way. Like, that's just so much fun. So, we have to start to, number one, get really clear on our emotions and then be willing to sit with them even when we are embarrassed or uncomfortable. And then perhaps at finding a way to ask for more information. fully acknowledging that it is not any person of color's job to educate us, right? So one of the ways that I will do that, I will say, when I'm being called out, I will say something along the lines of, thank you so much for telling me that. I am truly sorry. I would like to learn more, and I will. I plan on researching this. I plan on looking up more information about this. Is there something specific, if you have the time, the energy, or the desire to share with me, that you would like me to know more about? Right. So I'm totally and if they say, no, I really love for you to do your own work, then, hey, that's fine. Right. Because mm-hmm. that is our job. That's something that will happen often, is that white people go, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to be a racist jerk. So teach me how not to be a racist jerk now. Well, now you're just putting all of your stuff, your emotional labor back on this person of color. It's not their job to educate us. Mm-hmm. So that's a really big part of it.
No, it really is. It is realizing that it's that it's our work also to be able to do this, and that other people can grace us with their opinions on how we need to go down the road, but it isn't, yes, that we're not necessarily asking other people to do the difficult or the heavy lifting for us as we do this. And when you were mentioning part of your identity, you said you're a white woman, you said you're a Christian. Mm-hmm. And we all know, or hopefully, or people should know, that like one of the most segregated places days of the week is Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And you also talk, I loved how you talked about this, because I think you put it in a succinct manner that has bothered me within the church for many years, is that there's a huge difference between a church being involved in charity
mm-hmm.
and church being involved in justice.
Yes.
And, you know, just as I know somebody very closely within my familial circles that was bragging about, I'm going on my next, you know, my fourth missions trip now. Look at me, people. You know, and I was just like, oh, nice. Way to go, white wife. And, you know, yeah, I have my own issues. That's a whole different, uh-huh. Tearing apart missions trips is a whole different show that we could have a lot of fun with, too.
Totally.
But begin, I want you to speak into that a little bit about the fact that the church, I think some of the church's problems, where we get into that place of the charity versus justice. And there's a huge, one is comfortable, one is uncomfortable.
Yeah, totally, totally. Charity makes us feel great about ourselves, you know, and I think one of the greatest examples of how charity makes us feel great is how, as a country, we love to say, like, oh, we're going to go help these poor people in this other country, but God forbid they come to our borders and seek refuge. Like, oh no, that can't happen. You know, so there's that hypocrisy that's there, right? Because we have to really ask, what are we doing this for? Are we doing this to make ourselves feel better? Or are we doing this with an end? And charity perpetuates itself, right? If I continue to make this people group dependent on my charity, then I can continue to feed my own ego and I can continue to serve them. Mm. However, justice removes the obstacles that cause the systemic poverty that we're saying that we're going there to serve. It removes the access to resources. It removes systemic blockages to access to resources. It removes all of those things that are keeping people stuck in systemic poverty, that creates the need for us to go. So to build a well, or to give them, build a hospital that they can't build themselves, right? There's also a supremacy that is so inherent in most charity work, where it's this idea of, you know, white people going to Africa and telling the poor Africans, we know better how to fix your problems. Mm. When in reality, I think I haven't studied it to much degree, but I know I did study it a little bit. And the most successful, quote, charities, or the most successful, I guess, operations, I'll say, are operations that go in and with maybe resources that they then go to leaders in the communities who know their own communities and say, here, we want to offer you these resources. How would you use them to solve your problems, right? And those are some of the most successful operations where that really result in racial economic uplift of actual human beings, rather than perpetuating a system that makes white people feel great about ourselves.
Well, and you had mentioned, I think, a key component that you said earlier, that we don't do very well in our culture in general, not even talking about Christian culture, but the idea of listening. And, you know, I feel like we do a lot of, we're really good at waiting to speak, which can look like listening, but, you know, it's a whole different thing to be able to kind of sit there with like your palms up and just be like, tell me your truth.
Yes.
Like, lay it on me.
And teach me.
Yes. Teach me. Teach me. That is, yeah, that is a great way of putting it. Yes.
Yeah, like teach me, because there's actually a possibility that you know more than me about something. Like,
yes,
you know, yeah. Like, oh, I know that might sound crazy to a white person. And, you know, like, this is the thing. Before everybody is like, oh, she just hates white people. I don't hate white. I am a white people. I am married to a white person. I have white children. I love white people, literally, right? But I think that one of the things that we don't realize is that a culture of supremacy has been literally programmed into our brains through a number of different circuitries and entry points, whether it's media, messaging that you got from your family of origin, the school system, the justice system. All of these different systems kind of feed an idea of supremacy. So of course we walk through the world with this idea that we know more about stuff. That is something that's there. Our job is to take responsibility for it. Our job is to go, oh wait, that's a fallacy. That's a belief that I'm holding that I wish wasn't there, and I need to practice agency over it and practice some intentional listening.
And I want you to speak to this, because this was one thing that I've heard, and I feel like it's one of these, it's a thing that we're probably going to hear in different forms as we are moving towards the election cycle in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is, you brought up this one and I was like, oh, I hate it when I hear this. But you know, when people will say, well, what about like reverse racism? Mm-hmm. Like if we do all this, aren't we being oppressed too? Can you please respond to that?
Yes, please. I would love to. So the first thing that I want to say before I even really answer that question is that it, you know, one of the great strategies, I'm sure many people may have heard of the Southern strategy, and one of the great strategies of supremacist culture is to separate all of those who are oppressed. It really comes down to power and money, right? So separating those of us who are not doing as well economically, who are, you know, and I'm talking about the billionaires, the people who can literally pay off an entire school's, you know, university's student debt and not even blink an eye, right? Compared to the rest of us who are trying to work and put food on the table, right? Keeping us separate reduces our power, right? So I'm not saying that there aren't white people who are oppressed. What I'm saying is that there are, it is not possible for a white person to be systemically oppressed by people of color in this country. White people can be oppressed by the billionaires who try to keep them poor, but we can't be oppressed by other people of color. The reason that is important, and it's important to understand that when I say that, I'm talking about a very specific definition of racism that means it is a systemic, institutionalized reality. Yes, it is socially constructed, which means race is not real. It's not a biological thing. It's a social construct and it's fluid. I can walk into one room and be whiter in one room than I am in the other. And so can a lot of people. But race is, it's one of those things. I'm totally losing my train of thought here. Back me up. This is what happens when
you're talking about the different systems, and you're talking about,
thank you.
Yeah.
So the way that, the systems are at play and why, racism as a system, a white person cannot be oppressed in a racial system, is because these systems are designed to privilege us, and we have certain privileges that are just not existent for people of color without going through massive obstructions to that kind of justice, right? Now, that doesn't mean that a person of color can't be an asshole, right? A person of color can definitely be biased against you and me because we're white. A person of color can have racist or racialized thoughts and stereotypes in their brains about us, but they will never be able to exercise that as power systemically over you and me. And when I say that, I mean over our bodies, over our access to public space, over our access to education, over our access to jobs and employment, other economic resources like loans. There's no end to the ways that that racism is acts as a block to those types of societal resources for people of color that it, and it just doesn't for white people. Does that make sense? Did I answer after my little trail?
No, it was a good trail. I like that trail. Okay, good. I want to kind of just get to this idea of repentance and redemption, because I think for a lot of us, we live like America is a very individualistic culture. I mean, our culture is not very communal in nature. We're very individualistic. It's, you know, what's in it for me? You know, yep. I didn't do this. It's not my fault kind of a situation. But what I'm hearing more and more is that we also need to be open to repenting for the systems, repenting for history, repenting for many other things that even though we may have not had a direct hand in, that we may still be benefiting from as white people. But also want, if we care enough, we want to be able to stop this. So what is the road of repentance look like? What is that road?
That's a good question. I think I want to get this right, because I think it's probably the most important question. A lot of times in racial conversations, you'll hear people of color, often rightfully so, talk about centering whiteness and white tears, right? Especially among white women. White women tend, when we're confronted with racism, we tend to cry. When white men are confronted with racism, they tend to get angry. So those are our two kind of canned responses. One of the things that I have learned is I do sometimes cry when I'm angry or feeling defensive. There's a difference between a white person who is crying tears of, oh my gosh, you hurt my feelings by calling me a racist, and true mourning, true grief over what has been done to our siblings of color in this country. And I wrote the book because I actually do believe in the goodness of many white people, right? Of most white people. I really do. I think most of us truly are good. And we hate this idea that racism is happening, and we just don't know what to do about it. And so we take the easy way out, and we just say, it's not my problem. I can't do anything about that anyway, right? And so for those people, I believe that if those people were actually able to start confronting their own internalized racism, we could actually see a shift. We could actually see something shift here. And so the first thing has to be grief. It has to be real mourning. And I think that I'm talking like sackcloth and ashes kind of biblical ass mourning, you know, like the kind of grief where we tear our clothes over what has been done in our name. And that leads to lament, and lament leads to repentance, and repentance leads to action, which in my opinion has to be reparations, financial reparations. It can be so clearly demonstrated the way that the Black community has been financially decimated as a result of slavery and redlining and all the ways that we've blocked them from building wealth over generations. So that's just the first step, you know. But it definitely does need to come from a sense of deep grief. And let's face it, nobody willingly walks into those waters, right? Nobody says, I want to experience deep, heart-wrenching, soul-breaking grief. But I think that's what it's going to take. Mm-hmm.
Well, Carrie, I really appreciate your time here today. And the book, Good White Racist, it is a great read. It is a challenging read. It is an essential read. I think that for many of us, we need to do that, to go to that place of soul searching, to even get to the starting line.
Yes,
of even the road to redemption. It isn't like I read the book, good, I'm done. No. But Good White Racist drops on Amazon on March 17th. And so this is Carrie Connolly. Carrie, how do people find you if they want to find you?
The best way to find me is on my website, which is carrieconnolly.com. So that will take you to all the things. And if you're interested, you can sign up for my newsletter on that website, and you will automatically get a 10% off code for the class that I'm teaching at the School of Global Citizenry all around the book, where you'll get to interact with me, and we'll talk through these things and go even deeper. So I'm really excited about that. And but yeah, carrieconnolly.com is the best way.
And that's K-E-R-R-Y-C-O-N-N-E-L-L-Y?
Yep.
Okay, there we go. So we're .com as well, too. So Carrie, thank you so much for your time here. Thanks for being on the show. And I want to have you back on sometime, too.
Awesome. I would love that. This has been so much fun. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Carrie. Well, thanks again to Carrie for being on the show. And again, her book, Good White Racist. It is available on Amazon. It is a great read. I recommend it to all of you. But that is all the time we've got today on the show. So as we end this broadcast, just a reminder that you can catch this show and past shows on podcasts and anywhere else you find podcasts. We're there. Just look for Snarky Faith. So thank you again for joining us. And as I do every week, I send you out into the world with the holiest amount of grace and peace and snark. Go out into the world and make it better. Make it better than the way that you found it. Have an amazing week. I'll catch you guys again next time. See ya. Peace.
WCOM is listener-supported community radio, and Snarky Faith is only possible through our sponsors. Lumen, a spiritual community of seekers, sojourners, question askers, doubters, and skeptics, is a collective of fellow travelers that embrace the truth that all of life is sacred, hope is real, and tomorrow can be a better day than today. All are welcome. You can find more information at www.lumencommunities.com.